session number 16843, rule 4.
Christopher, you're four.
As I said, Captain Elliot, an army captain, and he was a practical joker, really. And then they brought back a lot of these hornets, you know, very large wasps. So David Hunter Marine had a very good idea. What he did, he got a lot of threads, and he tied the thread to the little hornets, big hornets. Then he got lots of bits of paper and wrote on the paper, "Deutschland ist kaputt," Germany is finished. When the Hitlerjugend used to come around, they used to come around with their bands and everything, he let out all these little hornets to flutter down. I don't know if they're ever found. That was what you call, you had to do something. Light relief, I should think. But it was 101 different things. Good gracious.
It seems surprising in a way that the Germans should have put all these naughty boys together.
They made a mistake. We could make anything. Someone made a pair of binoculars out of glasses. Well, I don't know how they made them, but they made them, you know, out of glasses. I think Tommy Elliot was one of them who used to use them. I forget now. And then, of course, the French, under Vernicourt, Count Vernicourt, they were there. They were under the sentence of death, really. They were all spies. But they were good at one thing, and that was making keys. They had one chap who would make all the keys we needed. And not only that, they're very good forgers. So they could get into the commandant to her office and get the stamps, etc., get the paper, and they could do all the forging for when you went, you see, when you left. You all had forged papers and money before you left. They were very, very handy.
How did they get into the commandatura office? Or with a key?
Just a key. Just a key. And, of course, some of the things we got away with, I don't know. I remember when the Swiss came in. They had to come in to have a look at us. And so we were given orders. Everybody had to get on the parade. Can you imagine it? There were Poles, French, English, Canadians crowded that courtyard, throwing balls about. And we said, of course, it was always like this, and it wasn't. And I remember they came upstairs, we were on the top floor, and one of our chaps, I don't know which one, he went to the window, and he was shouting filth at Germans. And the German lieutenant, whatever it was, he ordered them back, "Zurück, zurück," or he'll shoot. And eventually he did. He shot through the window. Fortunately, the Swiss had just come in and they ducked under the table. And once again they said, "Does this happen often?" Or, "It always happens." It never did, you see. And all these things went on. I don't know, well, David Hunt or someone, the Germans came in to take our thumbprints underneath one window. And when they were nicely assembled, David Hunt or someone, I think maybe him, filled some paper bags with water and, of course, just threw them out, drenched the whole lot, and that was the end of the thumbprints. No more fingerprints. But I don't know, they put up with all sorts that we wouldn't have put up with, I'm sure.
Why?
Hmm?
Why do you think they put up with?
I don't really know. You see, when we first went there, we had the young Germans who were rather keen and uppish. But later we got the old Germans. Now, they were different entirely. Entirely different. We had one who used to bring in the potatoes, and they used to be brought in by bullocks, towing a cart, and he'd been a prisoner somewhere in the First World War in Yorkshire. And he had a real strong Yorkshire accent, this little German. And they only brought them in by bullock because they brought a lorry in once and they couldn't get it out because we'd pinched everything from his wheel caps to whatever you can think Oh, dear, I don't know. As I say, there's so many things happening, and so many things did happen.
But didn't you get depressed at the thought that you were spending all these years in captivity?
Well, some did. Therefore, we had, I think we had at least three or four mental cases. That's when Dick Howe said there wasn't to be any escapes imitating mental cases. We tried to get them away, you know, but the Germans wouldn't let them go. Then there was a section that were a little apathetic, if you like to call it. But one doesn't talk about them, really.
You mean they didn't want to escape?
No, I don't know what, you know, they couldn't settle down. You see, the best thing to do as a POW is to work for an escape, dig a tunnel, keep your mind off England. Just keep your mind off home, you know, keep busy. And the majority of us actually did that, really. And time passed very, very slowly. And I remember not Tommy Elliot, the other Elliot, the practical joker, he used to do watercolours with John Watton, the artist. And he used to do all the seasons, spring, summer, autumn, of the same place. Can you imagine it? Every year. Or that was his way of keeping sane.
In some POW camps, they used to keep sane by doing things like examinations from papers sent from Britain, or putting on concert parties, or
we had
plays.
That's right. We had one concert party, I think, or one play. But unfortunately, you see, whenever we had a play, there was a reason. And the reason was it was means of escape. I had a walk-on part, I forget. But I'm afraid the next time I walked was down to the outside cells, caught again. Then, of course, the Germans said, no more. No more plays.
How did you use the play to try to escape then?
Well, because the escape route was through the back of the stage. And if we could get all the German officers up for the play, etc., etc., keep them busy while the chaps went their business, you know, to get out.
Was it a tunnel?
Yes. Oh, there were tunnels all over the place. The French had a tunnel that started up in the clock tower down below, down into the depths and out. They found they couldn't get on with it, so we got on with it. We started up on the stairs and got down that way, by the organ. Then there was another, Monty's Deep. He went from one side of trying to cross the parade. Then Bush Parker, he was thought of one in the where we had to get a hot shower once. I think it was once a month. Then there was a tunnel from the toilets up in one room. Then the French, they had another tunnel. The Poles had a tunnel. In fact, they had to have a committee meeting eventually to make sure that no one collided with each other.
That the tunnels didn't intersect, you mean?
That's right. Yeah. I don't know how many tunnels there would be in Goldritz. I really don't. Then we had means of way of getting into the parcel office, because that's where we get the dummy parcels, you know, with all the money and everything in them. They're all marked. Oh, it was all...
Which dummy parcels?
Well, the Red Cross, not the Red Cross parcels, the gift parcels. Used to come from England. And, of course, some of the tins and bits and pieces, they're all doctored. There was something in a tin somewhere, or something in a packet somewhere. You know, put in very, very cleverly.
These were escape materials that came from England.
Oh, yes. Yes. Everything... Well, there wasn't anything we couldn't do, really. We had all these experts.
Can you tell me how Colditz was liberated? What you remember about that, please?
Well, I remember about a week before we were actually liberated. We'd heard our bombers go over and bomb Leipzig, because we were between Dresden and Leipzig. And then one morning we woke up to see a lot of dots on the horizon, and there were the American tanks. And they were firing into the village here, then everywhere. Then we saw the refugees leaving, you know. Then we saw the planes coming down, strafing here, then everywhere. And then that night we went and we heard lots of bombing going on this then. And then a few tiles came off the roof. And the next day, the Americans were actually on the outskirts of Colditz, and they're just about to cross the Mulde. The bridge was supposed to be blown up, but it wasn't blown up. And they were, I think, within about the afternoon or morning sometimes, the Americans came in with all their, you know, grenades and all dressed to kill, of course. Fearsome lot. And then we heard from one of the officers that they thought, or that they were going to rather bomb the castle. But fortunately, they'd seen something hanging out the windows. And I think Dick Howe, security officer, given orders to put out POW in flags, you know. And so you didn't get bombed after all. And when they came in, the blatant lot brought in lots of food. Well, we hadn't been able to eat for about 6 weeks, you know. We were starved then, really starved. And we ate all this stuff, and of course, consequently, were very sick. We were greedy, over greedy. But the odd thing about it was, when they came in, there was a woman came with them. I think it was a war correspondent. And I don't think it's ever been mentioned. But there was this woman with the party. Anyhow, they came in and I think must have stayed overnight. Then Colonel Todd, that's our senior officer, he said we'd be allowed out until a certain time. We weren't allowed to do this and do that. And if we went into a pub for a drink, he said we were to pay for it and all that sort of thing. So anyhow, we went. I went out with a chap called Mike Moran, and we just walked around the countryside, down the river and back, come round. But when we went out, a lot of German women at the gate crying and want to know where their husbands were. Anyhow, it was pathetic, really. We got to a pub, I remember.
What had happened to their husbands?
Hmm?
What had happened to their husbands?
We didn't know. These were the guards. They'd been taken out, you know, they'd been put in prison, I should think, by then, by the Americans. Anyhow, we went into this pub, and we ordered two beers. We had enough money given to us. And the girl, a couple of girls behind, served us. And when we were going to pay, American said, "You don't pay. Nobody pays here." Good Lord, I said, but we've been told to pay our way. Got nothing to do with it. God, big chap. So he said, all right. And the girls behind, oh, they were terrified. Anyhow, nothing we could do about it. So we came back and got in eventually. And in a way, we're pleased to get back, because that was the only life we knew about at that time. And when we got back, we met Charlie Upham, the double VC. Remember? New Zealander? Double VC. There was Colonel Merritt, he was VC, and Charles Upham, he was the double VC. And he'd gone to a farm, he had more sense than us, and he came back with a load of eggs. So he was all right. Anyhow, the next morning we were given orders, pack up all your things, put them in a wooden crate, leave them behind. The Americans will take you to so-and-so, so-and-so. So we did what we were told to do. We are bundled into these trucks. And a black American driver, very cheery chap, he told us that there was lots of booze in the back, have as much as you like. Of course, a lot of us had a lot of this stuff, ill again. And then he drove on for about 2 hours, then he stopped at American gun battery. There were about 8 or 10 guns lined up. And we said, "What's this for?" He said, "Can't go any further at the moment." He said, "We're having a battle with the Germans over the way." And we waited, and all the Americans were just standing by their guns smoking. And suddenly a bell rung. Where went the cigarette? Loaded the guns, and off went all these shells. We waited. We heard the explosions. Then we waited for half an hour. He said, all right, you'll be all right now. Then they took us down to a place, I think, called Colledo. I'm not sure. K-O-L-I-D-I, Colledi. And when we got there, we boarded the, what do they call the old transport planes?
Dakotas?
Dakota, that's right. We boarded these planes, and off we went to, we must have crossed, we looked down, and we say, all this bombing, it looked like a plum pudding with the stones out, you know, where the bombing had been intense. Then we crossed the channel, and they landed us somewhere outside London. I don't know where. And first of all, we were taken into a hangar, and were deloused, you know, everything taken off, you know, given freshness, and given a tea and a bun and whatnot, and the band was playing all the time. Then we had to go to a hotel. I don't know where it was. They put us in the hotel, and they locked us in. So we decided we didn't like being locked in, so we opened the windows and tied all the bed sheets together and got out. And went for a walk. It must have been between 12 and 1 o'clock in the morning. When we had a when we had our walk, we came, knocked on the door, and they were surprised we came in. And then the next thing that happened the next morning, we're all the RN types, we're put into a bus, and off we went. The idea then, of course, was to go to London's, one of the railway stations, something like that. And I remember we stopped. No, we didn't stop. Mike Harvey, he's dead now, he went to the driver and he said, stop at the first pub. The driver said, against my orders, sir. He said, you'll either stop at the pub or we'll stop you at the pub. So we stopped at the pub. When we got there, there was all these people there cheering. They must have heard that we are on our way. And so we went in there and we had some beer, and it was a proper knees up. God. Never forget that.
Did they know you were from Colditz?
No, they just knew that POWs were on their way. And they gave us a very, very good send-off. Then, actually, I can't remember what happened. Just can't remember what happened. Memory seemed to go.
Some people I've interviewed have said that it was very difficult for them, immediately after the Second World War, to readjust to civilian life.
Well,
did you find that yourself?
Well, I found it odd, because when I remember going to Waterloo, I was at Waterloo Station to go down to Portsmouth, and I went to buy a bar of chocolate. They looked at me as though I was an idiot. I couldn't buy anything I wanted, you know. Nothing at all. And I was very odd. And I went down with another chap called Ivan Hewitt. He'd lost one of his eyes in the, that raid where the Campbelltown went in?
Nazaire, Saint-Nazaire.
Saint-Nazaire. Funny, he was in one MTB. Mickey Wynne, he's the Lord now.
Lord Newborough.
That's right. And he was in the other TB. He lost one eye, I think, right one. And Hewitt lost the left eye. And say they were, and they're both in these two boats. Anyhow, I travelled down with him, and I think he was on his way to Ireland. I forget now. We parted company. I remember going into the barracks, and when I got there, I was given 200 cigarettes and a carton and some money. And then I went into the wardroom, of course, had the usual drink. And guess what? When I came up out, someone had taken the cigarettes. So that was a fine homecoming.
But were there any psychological problems in readjusting to...
Well, I didn't seem to find any. Oh, I had to be... we had to go to Haslow for a physical, this, that, and everything else. I remember having had mine. He said, all right, you're all ready. You'll do All right, no, for the China Seas. Oh, I said, that's very nice. I can't remember. I can't remember very much about the first 2 or 3 months, which is very odd. But there was, I had nothing, no psychological effect, not at all.